Before we get started, I just wanted to thank you guys for coming back for another episode of The Places You'll Go. If you enjoy the podcast and want to get involved in the community or take a guess at our weekly photo teasers, like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at ThePlacesYG. If you have your own amazing stories to tell us, feedback about the show, or ideas for upcoming episodes, feel free to email us at theplacesyg@gmail.com or visit anchor.fm/theplacesyg to leave us a text or voice message. Finally, if you want more people to find out about how awesome this show is, follow us on Spotify and Overcast and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. Now, without further ado, enjoy this week's episode.
This is a Wandering Hippies production.
So we've made it back.
Hi.
It's late. I was writing all day because I waited till the last minute again because homework and work and everything else. But here we are. Not much has changed since the last time we spoke with you.
We are officially
Colorado
citizens.
Yes, we're officially citizens of the state of Colorado. We got our driver's license today. Our giant pieces of paper that are our temporary IDs that they expect you to carry around everywhere with you. So that's fun.
Yes.
And before too long, we'll get the car re-registered and you'll never even be able to tell we were from Iowa.
It'll be a ghost of a memory.
But we probably should wish our niece Evelyn happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday.
She's 3 whole years old. The day after you guys are there, the day before you guys hear this was her birthday. So she's getting big now.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. But other than that, we are getting ready to check another state off our list. We're rolling back into the deep south, deep into South Carolina, that is.
Oh.
That's Lakin.
And that's Chance.
And these are the places you'll go. The places you'll go. So it's time to venture into the Palmetto State. And honestly, I'm not sure why we've waited so long to go to South Carolina, because it is a really gorgeous state, which is almost enough for me to forgive it for starting the Civil War. Almost enough, but not enough. You guys got close. But anyway, we're specifically going to be exploring the quaint community of Spartanburg, South Carolina. Now, South Carolina itself was home to the native peoples since at least 13,000 BCE, with some evidence suggesting that they may have been in the region for as long as 50,000 years, which it would mean humans have been in North America much, much longer than we previously surmised. So that's pretty crazy to think about.
That is.
When European incursion occurred in 1600s, there were almost 30 distinct nations living in South Carolina, with the largest being the Cherokee Nation. And also that is the one that inhabited the area that would one day become Spartanburg. The Cherokee might be one of the nations that is most universally understood as a nation that Europeans interacted with the most during the early colonial period, clear through almost the Civil War. They are steeped in history, and thanks to their willingness to comply with colonialization, they were designated by Washington as one of the 5 civilized tribes, elevating their status in the eyes of the colonizers. Part of that compliance was the Cherokees' willingness to sell land to Britain. In 1629, however, prior to any land sales, King Charles I established the Carolina Province that covered the entirety of what would become both Carolinas, Georgia, and Tennessee. And of note, he named it the Latin name for Charles, Carolina. Like, conceited much?
What is it?
What?
What's the Latin name?
Carolina is the Latin name for Charles.
Oh, I thought that we just, like, bastardized it
then. No, that's basically, I mean, it's like Carolinia or something like that, but it's basically Carolina.
He likes himself.
Yeah, clearly. He liked himself an awful lot. The development of British colonial power in the South began early with the export of native captured slaves, around 50,000 of whom were exported from the Carolina province to other colonies.
Oh, these aren't civilized?
This was, these were before. This actually resulted in the destruction of many of those 30 nations that existed down there.
Yeah.
And 50,000 exported native slaves represents more. That's more people exported from the Carolina province than we ever imported of black African slaves.
So that's a
truly massive number of people.
I did not realize.
Yeah. By the 1700s, vast rice plantations had been established in the fertile lands of South Carolina, and imported black enslaved persons made up the overwhelming majority of the colony's population. During the American Revolution, nearly a third of all fighting in the entire war took place in the South Carolina colony, which was more than any other colony. But I don't remember learning that in school.
Me either.
I didn't realize there was so much of the Revolutionary War that took place.
I always just figure, like, in my mind, it was just like...
all in the Northeast.
Yes.
Yeah. Me too. But there was a lot of fighting in South Carolina, I guess. South Carolina also became the very first state to ratify the Articles of Confederation, the original document that founded the United States, and they were also the first to ratify the Articles of Confederation that formed the Confederacy. So that's kind of a weird synchronicity there. Now, honestly, they probably did it on purpose. Who knows?
Yeah, you're right.
But my larger point was that the American Revolution has very deep ties in South Carolina, and that's what takes us to Spartanburg. Before the war, the British called the British cut a deal with the Cherokee in 1853 to acquire the land that would become the city. But the community of Spartanburg would not develop until, I'm sorry, I said 1853, it was 1753, I apologize. 1753 they acquired that land. In 1785 was when Spartanburg was established, and it was named for the Spartan Regiment of the South Carolina Militia that fought in the Battle of Cowpens, very near modern-day Spartanburg. It was officially founded in 1787, but would not be incorporated as a city in South Carolina until 1831. Throughout the 1800s, Spartanburg developed as a railroad hub, with millions of pounds of tobacco, rice, and cotton moving through the city en route to the manufacturing centers of the Northeast. However, they were also almost 40 textile mills in the city, making itself a very serious manufacturing center, which was a pretty big anomaly in the antebellum South. The economy of Spartanburg indirectly relied on the slave trade for the goods that came in, but it was unusual as a city in that it was defined by manufacturing rather than the direct slave trade or massive plantations or anything like that.
Yeah.
This is where, at least on Wikipedia, we magically jump forward to World War One, because apparently nothing happened between 1860 and 1910 in South Carolina.
Nothing.
I suppose that's irrelevant.
Nothing.
Truth be told, the American Civil War actually was largely uneventful in Spartanburg. The war never made it that far south, but 14 regiments were mustered from the area for the Confederate Army, with around 600 Spartans never returning from the war.
Damn.
The community wasn't married to the idea of secession, given its ties to the North and exporting goods to the North. But ultimately, they joined the foolhardy cause. Spartanburg did suffer during Reconstruction, as many of the railroad lines to the North had been severed, and the city never really became the railroad hub that it once was again. By the 1950s, the city's manufacturing sector was on a rapid decline, and nearly every textile mill in the area had closed. And today, while BMW's only North American plant is in Spartanburg, the city, I'm sorry, Spartanburg. I keep wanting to say Spartanburg.
I know. I wanted to, too.
Yeah. The city now relies on its revolutionary history and the beautiful surroundings of upstate South Carolina to bolster its economy. And the area is truly very beautiful. And it's one that I would like to spend some time in. So when we go there, where should we stay?
We are going to stay at the Clevedale Historic Inn and Gardens.
Okay.
The Clevedale Inn has two very precious hosts, Pontheola and Paul, who are from St. Louis originally. What started out as just a bed and breakfast in 2013 quickly became a huge event center with 4 acres. They have, you know, they got a lot to work with. Yeah. So obviously they have an amazing spot for weddings, but they also have gardening club. They hold drag events, a party for the Kentucky Derby, big hats, the whole nine. And they have a bunch of other events that seem really cool. They have 4 gorgeous suites to choose from, and you won't be disappointed by any of these rooms. They even have one in an old train car, outside.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really cool.
It's pretty cool.
You can rent the entire venue if you would like to, like, when if you're vacationing with friends or if you're getting married there and you want people to stay.
Yeah.
Pontheola and Paul switch off in the kitchen, bringing you delicious southern breakfast, which, sign me up.
Yeah.
They even have an interactive guide for places to eat, visit, and enjoy, and, like, facts about the inn and when you can check in and all that kind of stuff.
Very cool.
They have extra packages you can purchase, like renting a giant bubble in the winter so you can enjoy your time outside and also keep warm. They have a wine package, a women's retreat package, and so many more. So go check them out. They seemed like the most, I was watching like videos of them like kind of just plugging the inn, and I'm like, they're too cute. So, yeah.
Okay. So, for recreation, this is, again, a gorgeous area with quite a bit to do and a lot of rural surroundings to it. But just southeast of town is a once bustling area that has been repurposed into a park. Croft State Park was once Camp Wadsworth, a World War I staging and training location. It is now home to the 165-acre Lake Craig, as well as 50 modern campsites, more than 40 miles of biking and equine trails, as well as 2.5 miles of hiking-only trails. This 7,054-acre park has a lot to offer for outdoor enthusiasts, from boat and kayak rentals to bird and wildlife watching, even to a show ring for the horse folks out there. There's quite a few amazing and interesting things to do in this gorgeous little state park, so be sure to check them out and learn a little bit more by visiting southcarolinaparks.com/croft. So, what fun things are we going to do?
We are going to start at the art scene in general in Spartanburg.
Okay.
It's huge. They have so many, what's the art studios called?
Galleries.
Galleries. They have so many of them.
Okay.
They have just a ton of art. Stop by the Clay King Studio and take a class on pottery. It's great for birthdays and I want to learn.
Yeah.
How to spin some pottery. You can check out a ballet at Ballet Spartanburg. At the Mayfair Art Studio, you will find 14 artist studios. Here, you will learn others' culture and how they make their art. They have 7 music studios for lessons and rehearsals, a ceramics room with 20 wheels, 2 dance studios, 2 exhibit event spaces, and photography studio. There are so many options in Spartanburg for the art enthusiasts, so be sure that you are checking out all of your options. And I have a website for you. That is www.visitspartanburg.com/things-2-do /arts.
Yes, you nailed it.
That's the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. I'm pretty sure of it. Anyway, let's get away from the art scene. It's killing me right now. There are plenty of places for the kids to enjoy. They have a Shipwreck Cove, which is a family-friendly water park, which I think all water parks are, but it'd be a lot cooler if they all weren't.
Hey.
Just kidding. I don't care. If you're feeling up to a challenge, check out the 6,000 square feet of rock climbing walls at Climb Upstate. They also have the Sparkle City Mini Putt-Putt Course, so
hey.
I hope y'all are ready. Then we have the Spartanburg Science Center. Here they have fun interactive exhibits to help you learn, and who doesn't like a little bit of hands-on activities?
Yeah.
The Science Center has a live animal room with reptiles, amphibians, and fish, as well as a bunch of other educational displays.
Nice.
And lastly, we're going to check out some live music at the Ground Zero Live Music Venue. Bands from all genres visit here, and there is music every single weekend. Cool. So,
that's really cool.
Check those places out, y'all.
Yeah, for sure. So, Spartanburg is also kind of a little bit of a college town. There's actually like 4 colleges in there, just none of them are like major. So, there's quite a few restaurants. On top of that, it's also just like a decently sized community. So there's a lot of places to eat and things to do. And one cute little place really stood out to me amongst all the others. And that is a restaurant called Sugar and Spice. It is a family owned burger shop, but it's a little bit more than that. For 60 years, this eatery has been a go-to for Spartans and remains the last standing drive-in with the exception of Sonic. In the entire city. They offer a unique slice of Americana that makes it a great stop for a burger and a shake. While the menu may not be anything to write to culinary school about, the opportunity to visit a drive-in that is a flashback to the 1960s makes it well worth the trip if you're in town. So be sure to check them out on Facebook because they don't have a website, and you can learn a little bit more about this unique little restaurant. So now it's Beer-Palooza time.
Beer, beer, beer-palooza. Beer, beer.
Just outside of town is a cool little brewery owned by a couple of brothers, and that is Holiday Brewery. Holiday Brewing is a family affair with beers inspired by the collective love of travel and adventure. I am, of course, again, quoting from their about section because they did a great job.
Yeah.
For more than 10 years, head brewer slash partner John Holiday has created award-winning beers at home. And he also worked for decades in a manufacturing environment, most recently at San Diego's White Labs, the area's biggest manufacturer for yeast for the craft brewing industry.
Yeast!
Partners Jim and Karen Holiday bring decades of experience in business management, manufacturing, and marketing. Mike Cater has provided expertise and resources, including the services of the Sun City Woodworkers, to make the Holiday Brewing dream a reality. The Holiday Children have also provided inspiration and ideas to ensure that Holiday Brewing is a true reflection of what they are about. Their beers are inspired by all of the travels that they have gone on, from Costa Rican coffee stouts to West Coast IPAs to Belgian beers. There's just a lot that we can get behind here at the places you'll go.
Yes.
Travel and beer.
Absolutely.
And they're definitely creating an amazing space to build community and family, so be sure to check them out on holidaybrewing.com. And holiday is spelled H-O-L-L-I-D-A-Y. So with that, we're going to get ready for the first story. So this week, Lakin is going to be leading us out. So this...
Go ahead.
So this week, Lakin is going to be leading us out with her story, as hers, I believe, is true crime. So take us away.
Ernie. Did you think I was going to pull McMurray on you?
I didn't know. Maybe.
Me either. I didn't know. Okay. I titled this A Kidnapping and a Cold Case. There is a trigger warning, violent gun crimes, kidnapping, and sexual assault. So this is your time to skip on through, or if you're a freak like me, tune on in. Anyway, Noel had just got off the phone with his buddy, Scott Ponder. Scott owned and worked at the Superbike Motorsports in Chesney, South Carolina. After talking to Scott and confirming he was working, Noel decided to head to the store to visit his friend and check out some merchandise. 7 minutes after hanging up the phone, Noel arrived at the store. There he found his friend Scott lying on the ground, lifeless. He immediately parked his car and got out to investigate. From there, he could see the front door to the shop and notice another employee, Brian Lucas, on the ground as well. He entered the building to find the bike mechanic, Chris Sherbert's body draped over a motorcycle like he had been actively working on the bike as he was being attacked. He then found Scott Ponder's mother, Beverly Guy, laying next to the bathroom door, and it looked like she had been ambushed. All of them were dead, and all of them with multiple gunshot wounds. He calls 911, and the Spartanburg deputies were the first to arrive on the scene. There was very little to go off of. There was no evidence other than a couple of shells from a 9mm pistol. In less than 7 minutes, someone had killed 4 people and fled the scene without many witnesses. But there was an eyewitness who had been in the store minutes before the shooting and was able to give the police a description of who he thought might be the shooter. So no names, because no one knows who this man is. But he's a white male, about 6 foot tall, 250 pounds to 300 pounds, with feathered hair, and a sketch was created of the man. The man was seen in a leather... The man was seen in a leather coat checking out a bike and asking about a good beginner's model. The theories start to run wild after this. Chris Sherbert was due in court November 7th, the day after the shooting occurred. Chris was supposed to stand trial for a drug-related crime and was looking at some jail time. Some speculated that he might have been dropping the names of his drug dealers in court, and the drug dealers took care of him first. That went cold.
Okay.
So then, a year after the crime had been committed, Scott Ponder's wife was called into the Spartanburg's Sheriff's Department. Why is it so hard to say Spartanburg? Add an S.
Yeah, I don't know.
People from Spartanburg are like, shut up, it's easy. Anyway. She had been in the office so many times, she didn't even think, she thought nothing of it. This time, however, was completely different. The deputies informed Melissa Ponder that they had taken the dirty diaper of Scott and Melissa's son from the trash and compared the DNA of the diaper to the blood found at the scene of the crime. There, they informed Melissa that Scott was not Scotty Jr.'s dad.
Oh.
Brian Lucas was.
Oh.
So this turned the officers on to a wild goose chase that eventually came up with nothing more than a love triangle.
Okay.
Which, messy and embarrassing.
Right. Yeah.
But they're like, they're trying their best. They're trying to figure out.
Yeah. See if there was a motive there.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to fast forward to August 31st, 2016. Kayla Brown and Charles David Carver went missing after they went to clean up some brush on some property owned by a real estate agent, Todd Colhep. Charles David Carver had been active on Facebook. His account had been posting things, but not things that Carver would normally post. Police were suspicious and were able to look into the records that showed where Carver's cell phone had last pinged off a cell phone tower, which led them to Colhep's property.
Okay.
They started a search of the property and came across an old shipping container and heard loud banging and yelling from inside. There they found Kayla Brown chained up inside. Brown told the authorities that Carver had been shot and killed, and after a quick search of the property, they found Carver's car in a ravine covered in brush.
Hmm.
Which, this is in November. Yeah. This is November 6th.
Okay.
So, when asked who had done this, Kayla replied, Todd Kohlhepp had chained Kayla there and murdered Charles David Carver. She had been in there since August 31st. Kayla had witnessed Charles being shot. Todd killed him because he was mad at Kayla for disobeying him. Kayla suffered through months of torture and rape, all while Kohlhepp was telling her that he liked her and she did nothing wrong, so he would keep her alive. The police found Kohlhepp on the same day, so November 6th, and he immediately confessed to all of his crimes. He had done this to another couple, Johnny Joe Coxey and Megan Lee McCraw Coxey, in the same manner. Murdered the husband, male partner, and then kept the female for a while.
Okay.
He told the officers that he had buried all three of them on his property, and the officers did find all three of them on his property. But here's where it gets really weird. He then blows the minds of the investigators when he confessed to the quadruple homicide at the Superbike Motorsports.
Oh.
A comparison of the sketch done at the time of the murders and Kohlhepp's photo are identical. Like, I have goosebumps right now. They're obviously spot the same on. Person. Yeah. Which, I mean, they can't technically go, like, police right, can't really right. go with that, but it turns out that Kohlhepp had been to prison for kidnapping and sexually assaulting a 15-year-old girl in Tempe, Arizona. He threatened her with a 22 caliber revolver, took her back to his home, taped her mouth shut, and raped her. He was 16 at the time.
Sheesh.
And was tried as an adult, where he spent 14 years in prison and was registered as a sex offender. He was released out of prison and moved back in with his mom in Spartanburg. There he got 2 bachelor's degrees and his real estate license.
Okay.
Character testimonies to police officers came flooding in. From people that Kohlhepp worked with saying that he watched porn at work. And a lady who bought a house from him that said he was very professional but dropped sexual innuendos, but not so subtly.
Oh.
A Waffle House waitress was interviewed where Kohlhepp often frequented and said that she and other waitresses were so uncomfortable by his presence that she would have one of the male cooks come to take his order, so none of them had to.
Hmm.
So, watch for the sign, folks. It might just save your life.
Yeah.
Also, something really crazy is, he got arrested on November 6th, the day, the anniversary of
the
bike shop murders.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really...
That's pretty wild.
This man suffers from borderline personality disorder, and he had a rough childhood, which I'm not excusing his behavior by any means, but like...
Right.
There's some fucked up shit.
Yeah.
Like, he talked about the 4 murders at the bike shop and, like, said that it was, like, a video game to him. We're all worried about the youth, but
yeah.
Look towards those middle-aged men, y'all. I just pointed a finger at my brain, so.
She's the brain of a middle-aged man.
You know, I mean business. So, yeah, that's my fucked up story.
That was interesting, that's for sure.
Isn't that kind of crazy, though?
Yeah, like, that is real. That's wild.
It's kind of like he learned in prison, like, don't leave survivors.
Yeah. That's something else, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I suppose we'll go ahead and take a break, and then I'll tell my story. Okay, so we're back. We're going to get fired up with my story. So I guess here we go. The title of this story is Never at Rest.
Ooh.
So I don't do a ton of hauntings on the show because it is incredibly difficult to find reliable information.
Yes.
About purportedly haunted locations. But some of the locations I can get behind are cemeteries.
Oh, same.
It's easy to identify who is buried there and how long they've been buried there. And even how they died in some cases. While Charleston, South Carolina has a storied reputation for its strange happenings and hauntings, Spartanburg has a location that might be even more peculiar and frightening. The oldest cemetery in the city is one called Oakwood Cemetery, and it has a long and haunting history. Commissioned in 1883, Oakwood would quickly become the most popular cemetery in the city, becoming the final resting place for thousands of Spartans. During that early rush of business for the beautiful Garden of Remembrance, many people who nobody will ever remember were laid to rest there as well. A portion of the graveyard was set aside as a pauper's cemetery. For those who may not know, a pauper's grave is a place where those who have no family are placed in their final resting places. Wards of the state, prisoners, unclaimed murder victims, that's just a few of the groups who were buried in pauper's graves. Now that's not to say they literally had no families. They just didn't have families who cared about them. And that's almost more tragic than not having a family at all. Then in 1941, after decades of popularity, as the world gravitated towards war, the board of directors of the cemetery went bankrupt. Oakwood fell into disrepair and became a dilapidated pit of death and despair. This is, I imagine, when it earned the nickname Hell's Gate.
Ooh.
The image of dirty, broken headstones, unkempt grass, and Spanish moss drooping from the live oaks to integrate with these skyward-reaching weeds paints the perfect picture of what Oakwood looked like for more than two decades.
That actually sounds pretty cool. I know, it's really disrespectful.
I'd kind of want to visit that.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love Spanish moss.
Me too. I like old cemeteries also.
Yeah, same.
Then in 1983, Martha Chapman reformed the board of directors and fought to get the cemetery funded again, saving it from becoming a forever defunct place of rest.
Mm, that's nice.
She personally oversaw the maintenance of the grounds and beautified Oakwood until it became a popular place to allow loved ones to rest forever again. But some of the vestiges of its days of disrepair linger on, like the nickname Hell's Gate. I would also imagine that some of the strange tales that originate in the graveyard might have cropped up in the 22 years when it remained mostly unmaintained.
Yeah.
Visitors today frequently report glowing orbs of light in the older parts of the cemetery, forever just out of view. And when they attempt to get a closer look, the lights just fade out.
Ooh.
Others still report moaning in the distance, just far enough away that one cannot pinpoint exactly where they're coming from. But the ruddy tombstones and crypts in the oldest segments seem to be a likely culprit. Some graves remain to this day shrouded in the edge of the forest long forgotten to time, with nobody to visit them. And though almost completely unmarked, the paupers are still there too. One could imagine the mournful sobbing that some report from the distant reaches of the cemetery are the souls that maybe nobody remembers.
Yeah.
One entity in the cemetery stands out amongst all the rest, however, and that is the Lady in White. She has been seen time and again in the graveyard, watching carefully over the souls that rest there. Some have even reported that she guides them to specific resting places, though with no rhyme or reason, usually. One visitor late at night in the cemetery saw the apparition of the woman in the distance. She stared at the visitor and he felt compelled to follow her. Though she would not allow him to grow close to her, she came to a stop at a marker near the oldest portion of Oakwood. As he approached, she faded into the heavy air of the South Carolina night, and he read the stone. It seemed at first unremarkable, but for whatever reason, the name stuck with him. He returned home and decided to do a little bit of research on the name that was on that stone she had guided him to. And he discovered it was the grave of a long-forgotten member of his own family.
No.
Though he never again saw the lady in white, he returned every year to that same night to visit the grave of his kin. And maybe that's all she wanted. Maybe that's all the soul in that grave wanted, and she knew.
Oh.
It's a wild story.
Yeah.
The fact is, thousands of people were laid to rest here, and if any place is haunted, it's got to be this one. You can take tours of the cemetery as well as nighttime tours, specifically for ghost hunting. The grounds have so much history to offer and so much to experience, both paranormal and just normal, interesting things. But I urge you, if you choose to visit, please be respectful and understand that some of the energies that you might encounter may never be able to rest. This is their home and the place they are forced to wander for eternity, and you're just a visitor. But I have one more quick note. Buried in Oakwood is the savior of Oakwood, Martha Chapman. She cared so much for the innumerable people buried there and for the grounds. I'd like to imagine that she is the lady in white, forever watching over the dead, forever guiding the living. Never at rest.
You got me there.
I was like, man, what are the odds of that, though? Like,
yeah.
She's buried there. She loved that cemetery. Like, what if she's the lady in white?
Yeah.
Like, everybody imagines, like, some sort of a spectral haunting is some lady that died in the 1800s or something. Like, what if it's this lady that died in the fucking 90s?
Yeah.
And she's just hanging around.
Helping,
yeah.
Yeah, really, paupers' graves are pretty sad. And, like, I remember hearing about, like, sometimes families wouldn't claim them because they also didn't have money.
Yeah.
And so, like,
yeah.
I'm really sad.
Very, yeah. The whole concept behind a pauper's cemetery is incredibly depressing. Like, just because nobody claimed them, they don't deserve a tombstone of their own.
Right. You know, the fact about, like, dying is so expensive is pretty sad in general.
In and of itself, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also, like, a part that I didn't include in the main story, but I guess in, like, 2012, I think it was, there was some development happening in a different part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cemetery there, like a small cemetery. So they moved all of the graves from that cemetery into Oakwood.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a point in time where there was a big uptick in activity at Oakwood. And I would imagine,
okay,
you were uprooted from your final resting place, that might cause a little stir in the...
Yeah.
In the veil, if you will.
Man, guys, if I die, I don't want to haunt. I just want to go to whatever else.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, watching...
I don't want to be stuck in a cemetery.
Watching Surviving Death, which is a great show on Netflix. If you are afraid to die, watch it. And it also, I feel like it's kind of helpful for, like, people in mourning. But, like, they had people with near-death experiences and, like, hospice patients on their way, you know, like, on their way to the next life. And it was like, I don't know, like the near-death experiences were all so positive, and, you know, like it, they just went to like the most peaceful place. And yeah. I don't, and they saw like their relatives who had passed, and I don't know, it was just like really beautiful. And
right.
Like before I was really afraid of death, but now I'd like, it would be okay. Not right now.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Right.
But like when it happens.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. So I suggest you guys go check that out.
Yeah.
It's very good.
It was good. But yeah, I guess those are our stories for this week. I hope you enjoyed them. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, eventually, we'll release the first episode of The Things You Should Know. We're running into some hiccups on that. Time constraints and...
Chance works a lot.
I work a lot.
Chance works a lot of overtime.
And I commute almost 2 hours round trip.
And he's going to school.
Yeah.
He has big dreams.
I do.
So, those dreams might have to wait till next week, though.
Probably. I can't imagine we release it.
But maybe.
But you never know.
You never know.
You never know. But Spartanburg, you're going to have to get off the interstate to visit that. And when you're there, I'm sure you're going to see some incredibly beautiful countryside.
You're probably going to have to go rock climbing.
You might go explore a haunted cemetery.
Ooh. Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully that. Also, you're probably going to drink some delicious holiday beer.
And I'm sure you're going to meet some great people. And hopefully...
these are the places you'll go.